The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
In a lawsuit filed in 2016, they allege YouTube parent company Google gave material support to ISIS by not only allowing the group to post videos, but by promoting them through algorithms that recommend content to other users. But Gonzalez has been unable to even make the case in court because of a landmark law known as Section 230 of the Federal Communications Decency Act, which gives sweeping immunity to social media companies.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, hey, good afternoon. Let's talk about that and a whole lot more. It's good to be here with you today. Thanks for joining me. Big tech could be seeing a major shakeup in the near future. The Supreme Court's considering whether to take cases from Texas and Florida, where those states have said companies like, you know, Twitter and TikTok and Meta and Snap, and well, they can't remove content they don't like. And those laws came after large numbers of complaints about big tech censoring conservatives, right, over what is alleged, and I'm going to put these in air quotes, you know, air quote, misinformation, end of quote. And the companies always, you know, being the one that gets to define what that misinformation is. Next month, the court's going to be scheduled to hear a case about Section 230. You might have heard a lot about that. That shields the platforms, as you heard in the audio clip, from liability for content posted by their users. With that law in place, the companies, they can't be sued, for instance, if somebody gets killed because of, you know, what one or more users have posted. And depending on the outcomes of those hearings, there could be major, major changes for big tech. And I can actually see both sides of the argument here. I mean, you really can. That's a tough issue. We'll see how the court ultimately rules, but it'll be a big decision. Speaking of the court, social media is being used right now to rally people to Justice Brett Kavanaugh's house to protest him. I saw the story and I was like, why? Right? I mean, first of all, this is a sitting Supreme Court justice, right? Remember, there was an assassination attempt against him. And what do we see? We see a group of 50, I don't know how many people. I was going to say 50 people. I don't know how many people showed up, but a group of people. They showed up this past Sunday, right? And this past Sunday, of course, was the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which is no more, right? Yeah. I love saying that. I do. I mean, honestly, come on now. Did you ever think you'd see Roe fall? Right. I was, you know, I knew it would pass, but man, the pieces had to be in the right place. And yeah, we had a very conservative president nominated three conservative Supreme Court justices. It was bad law. We had the right case, the Dobbs decision, right? And Roe is now history. But boy, they can't let it go. It's over, right? It's over. Now the fight's at the state level, but you had a bunch of protesters show up outside of Justice Kennedy's Justice Kavanaugh's house. Here's a little bit of that audio. Listen to this.
Cut his time short.
A rapist should not rule the court.
Cut his time short.
A rapist should not rule the court.
Cut his time short.
A rapist should not rule the court.
Cut his time short.
A rapist should not rule the court.
Cut his time short.
A rapist should not rule the court.
Cut.
On it goes on, it goes on and on, right? I mean, it's ridiculous is really what it is. Cut his time short, a rapist should. That man was drugged through the mud, right? He was drugged through the mud during his nominations. I mean, God bless Amy Coney Barrett. She knew what was coming, right? And, of course, he was targeted in May of last year after the Dobbs decision was leaked and a guy flew all the way from California. He flew and tried to kill him and his family in the middle of the night. Remember, he came with zip ties and a gun and all the rest. Fortunately, the would-be attacker was caught before he could do anybody harm. But you almost have to wonder if these incidences, you know, won't have some influence over how the six conservative judges who've been targeted, you know, vote on the big tech case. I'm hoping it doesn't. I'm assuming that they understand their position and they will interpret the way that they should and not be intimidated. But that's exactly what we're seeing here. These are intimidation factors. And I don't think they're just. I don't think they should be able to do this. But, you know, we'll see what happens. Classified documents seem to be all over the place, too, don't they? That's crazy. I was shocked, to be honest. When this next piece of news came my way about Vice President Pence, right? Of course, we have what? We've got the former president. We've got Donald Trump. who had them at his Margo, you know, his Mar-a-Lago state in Florida. How many there were, what were in them. President Joe Biden had them at his place too. And again, you know, we know how many have come to light, but I always wonder when you are investigating yourself, you know, if there's real incriminating stuff that just kind of gets buried, right? Or gets put back or destroyed or never comes to light and you let the less incriminating stuff go. I don't know. I know nobody really raided President Biden's place without knowing, you know, without him really knowing they're going to be there. But they found stuff at his former think tank, in his home, in his garage next to his 67 Corvette. And, you know, the New York Times, reporter who was reporting on this piece that I saw was reading through Hunter Biden's laptop, says there's cause to believe that the president's son had access to the documents. So that's something that needs to be investigated, too, and looked into. But now it's not just the two presidents, right? And Trump actually came out and said, everybody does this, right? Well, look, I think President Trump and I think President Biden, they should all be held to the same standard as anybody else who has to do time or faces penalty for taking our nation's top classified secrets and putting them in places where they're completely vulnerable. And I think the Biden situation is the worst of them all. This is not partisan, so don't interpret it as such. But when you got boxes in a garage and you got a guy like Hunter Biden and you've got connections to China and to Ukraine and a lot of these other places, that's really troubling, really, really troubling to me. All of these situations are wrong. So, you know, Vice President Pence, Mike Pence, he found some in his house, right? After the initial report about Biden's documents, he ordered his team, look, you better go to my place, you know, do a thorough search of my home and the PAC headquarters, see if there's any stuff that's not supposed to be there. Now, in my opinion, this Mike Pence is squeaky clean, right? He really is. I mean, he's a very moral man. He tithes. He's pro-life. I did catch a piece of an interview he did before. I don't know. It was last year in January where he was asked this question. I think it was January of this year. Do you have any classified documents? And he actually said no. But I guess that question must have pricked his conscience or his mind. And maybe these things inadvertently get there. I don't know. I'm not going to make excuses, but the FBI already has them. The Pence lawyer said there was a small number of documents bearing classified markings which were inadvertently boxed. They were inadvertently transported to the personal home of the former vice president at the end of the last administration. Apparently, there's this rush to, of course, change administrations and get out. Apparently, they were taped up and never opened. So that's a good sign. But what exactly was in those boxes, what those documents are, again, like Biden and like Trump, we do not know. It's a continuing story, and we'll continue to follow it and see what happens and what kind of justice is ultimately meted out for this. And I've heard other senators and people in these top who have top, you know, security clearances say they've never taken anything like this. I mean, you go into the skiff, you're supposed to leave it there, right? How do you walk out with this stuff and why, right? Especially when you're a vice president or a senator. That's the problem. I mean, with Biden, you know, he took stuff when he was a senator, right? There's something I want you to pray about too, just in terms of national security, right? You worry about information that gets leaked. We know the Chinese have hacked so much of our intellectual property. Some of their latest fighter jets mimic really a lot of ours. They've stolen a lot of our technology. I received reports just before coming in the studio that there's a Russian frigate that is somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean heading towards the U.S. And, you know, you might say, well, that's not really unusual, Drew. What's unusual about this ship is that it is carrying hypersonic Zircon missiles. Now, if you're not familiar with them, these are missiles that can fly at 9 times the speed of sound. 9 times the speed of sound. And the distance on these things? More than 600 miles. So you're talking about a weapon that is really, really difficult to defend against, right? Really difficult. According to CNBC, the Russian Defense Ministry claims they carried out hypersonic missile exercises with this frigate. But then they said they did that using computer simulation. So we'll see what happens. You've got to understand the situation. And we'll talk about Ukraine a little bit later in this hour. I think it's well worth discussing because you've got Britain, you've got Germany, you've got the U.S. now sending tanks. You've got the U.S. training Ukrainian personnel at U.S. bases on our Patriot missile defense systems. And you wonder how Vladimir Putin and Russia interpret that and whether or not this will somehow ratchet up. I really think we need to pray for peace. We do. I mean, I hope you do. I try to. When I see stories like this, I pray. I ask God for his mercy. Remember it in the chaplet. Prayer can mitigate these situations. It can diffuse them. It can bring about peace. And that's what we need. That is what we need to do because things can go bad pretty quickly. And we do not want to see that. And I guess that's maybe why we've had the people from the Doomsday Clock on this program in the past. I don't know if you're familiar with what the Doomsday Clock is all about. It moved 10 seconds closer to midnight, and I'll fill you in on it. But when you consider what's going on right now in Ukraine, when you look at the tensions with China over Taiwan, when you look at the U.S., actually, they're saying we are depleting a lot of our armaments, feeding this to Ukraine. I wonder if there's a bigger picture. China waiting for us to get a little bit low, or Russia, is it all part of a bigger picture? Or is it something very simple? For what it is, will some of our adversaries see this as aggression? So it's little wonder why the so-called doomsday clock is now closer to midnight than it has ever been. Here's a little bit more on the doomsday clock. Listen to this.
The world's doomsday clock has been moved forward to 90 seconds to midnight. It's the first time the clock has moved since the pandemic in 2020. The doomsday clock is a metaphor for worldwide collapse, which is agreed on by experts at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Russia's threats of using nuclear weapons in the war of Ukraine sparked the clock's adjustment.
So the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, they've been on the show in the past, they set this clock up years ago. As you heard, he called it a metaphor. They actually have a little clock. They move the hand on it. You can see it. Just to give you a visual depiction of how close we are to destruction or an apocalypse, to nuclear apocalypse, really. And they have now set it to just a minute and a half, a mere 90 seconds before midnight, meaning they fear that the situations globally are so tense and so intense that we're very close to a nightmare. The bulletin statement said this. They said the decision was, quote, influenced by continuing threats posed by the climate crisis and the breakdown of global norms and institutions needed to mitigate risk associated with advancing technologies and biological threats such as COVID-19. So thanks be to God, though, we have our faith in the Lord. Thanks be to God, you and I are prayer warriors. Our faith is not in man. It's not in humanity, right? But it's in God. And God can change a human heart. And I believe people are inherently good. I do. But boy, we do live in a very corrupt time. One other issue here, and then let's talk Ukraine for a moment. I just want to put this on your radar. Something I'd seen. I think this is awesome. The USCCB, that stands for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, are going to be holding a songwriting contest. And I don't know if you heard about this. So if you are a songwriter, you might want to break out, your pen and paper or however you write your things. They're calling for all songwriters to create music for this Eucharistic revival. And they're not just looking for new hymns. They're looking for a theme song for the revival. Now, I don't remember, and I'm trying to pull this from memory, and somebody can clearly correct me on this if you'd like to. Was it Dana or Donna? She's the Irish musician and entertainer and singer who wrote what really was a beautiful hymn for the Eucharistic. John Paul II was over here. I think we had some sort of Year of the Eucharist. She wrote something. I mean, it's a hymn that is absolutely gorgeous. It's still sung to this day. But I don't know. If you know what I'm talking about, help me out here, because I don't know what I'm talking about. I just remember there was a tune that was written. It was really, really good. But winners are going to be announced at the Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis next year. And you get to perform your music live, your song. And you're going to be given a prize, too, $2,500. And you can go to EucharisticCongress.org/musical composition to find out. That's EucharisticCongress.org/musical competition. You can find out more. I'll do my due diligence. Did you find out, Mary? No, not Mary. Maggie. Did you? I'll try to look up the history behind that, behind Dana's song. I think it was called One Body. You know, I don't want to sing. Every radio in America will turn out if I start singing. You know, I think the song she wrote was One Body. We are one body. Check. See what you can find. Patrick Alog should get on it. He's pretty good at it. He can find out. I do want to talk about what's happening also with these abortion clinics. And there's a lot of news there. James Harden is going to be stopping. I see some calls coming in, Maggie. Maybe somebody's got an answer for me. Maybe those guys could screen those calls pretty quickly. We'll see what happens. So as I tread water, trying to pull things from the cobwebs of my mind. Last night, there was finally some progress announced in one investigation into attacks against pro-life pregnancy centers. A 27-year-old named Caleb Freestone and a 23-year-old named Amber Smith Stewart were arrested in Florida. And the grand jury has actually indicted them in attacks on these three centers in Florida. I'm delighted to hear that. I want justice, but way too many attacks on these pro-life centers, and nothing at all has been done, right? Well, we finally have some arrests. The facilities in Winter Haven and Hollywood were graffiti. There was another one there, too, somewhere. And you remember this. We talked about this, right? Statements were put on the abortion walls like, if abortions aren't safe, then neither are you. And there were threats like, your time is up. We're coming for you. You know, we are everywhere. So they had all these threats. Fortunately, the graffiti was all that happened, nothing more. It was just threats. But suspects allegedly had ties to Antifa. They're now being charged with violation of the FACE Act since they allegedly interfered with the delivery of a reproductive health care center. So this should be the first of a string of arrests. Whether or not we'll have more, that has yet to be seen. But meanwhile, there is a trial taking place in a federal courtroom in Philadelphia I want to tell you about. But first, Maggie, you've got the title. Do you have the title?
We Are One Body by Dana Rosemary Scallion. Yeah. Somebody just called in and told Patrick.
Dana Scallion, right? Or Dana. I think she goes by Dana. So that's it. We Are One Body. That's what I thought. Do you know what it was for? Was it for a Eucharistic Congress? I forget. All right. Well, thank you for following up. I was on the money. I was close. Just couldn't remember the full name or the song. But there you got it. So, hey, back to the old screenwriter stuff or the music writers. Write your song. You know, you may be sung in churches and around the world. I know her song was. And she wrote a really beautiful piece. Hey, in Philadelphia, right? I don't know if you're following the story. I think the guy's last name is Hoke, H-O-U-C-K. He's on trial for allegedly violating the FACE Act as well. There was a confrontation with a clinic escort after the escort started yelling at his son. I think he had an 11 or 12-year-old son. And, of course, what happened? Because there was a little shoving match out there. The father said he was protecting his son, and the abortion clinic worker said, you know, this guy violated the FACE Act. Well, the FBI, in the middle of the night, they infamously raided his home in rural Pennsylvania. They had their guns drawn. And, of course, the Thomas More Society, a great group, is representing him. And they came out, presented evidence last week to a judge that Congress specifically did not include clinic escorts in the protections provided by the FACE Act. So I'm joined today to just get a sense for where we are on this case and what's unfolding right now by the Reverend Jim Harden. He's CEO of Compass Care Pro-Life Clinic in Buffalo, New York. You remember them. They were firebombed. And guess what? Law enforcement still haven't located any perpetrators. Hey, Reverend, good to have you back with me. Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me back, Drew. It's an honor to be with you as usual.
Yeah, so what is the latest? Give me your take on what we are now seeing here. First, let's talk about the arrests that we do have on those who violated some of these, who've graffitied some of these places. Did those arrests come as a surprise to you, or were you expecting those?
Well, given how political and politicized the FBI and the DOJ have gotten, you know, I've been kind of chuckling all morning to myself, like it just seems too perfect. The FBI is embroiled in an investigation for abdicating their duty to investigate themselves, right? The attacks, the violence against pro-life people and organizations, and then they come out with additional reward money for 9 additional attacks on pregnancy centers. A day before that happened, these indictments occurred. This is very important because this is the first time that we're aware of that any pro-abortion extremist has ever been indicted on FACE Act violations, ever.
Wow.
The FACE Act, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrance Act, was initially created in the Clinton era to cool pro-life activity outside of abortion clinics. And so they intentionally created this federal law to attack pro-life people, and that's exactly how it's been used. Even this past year, 2022, we saw 26 trumped up, FACE Act violations targeting specifically peaceful pro-life people like Mark Houck and his family in Pennsylvania. And we said this was going to happen. We said the next step after the FBI abdicated their duty to investigate these multiple nationwide attacks on pro-lifers, they were going to go on the attack themselves. And they did through character assassination. And that's when you treat a pro-lifer, a peaceful pro-lifer, like a violent gang leader using SWAT raids to attack their house, that makes it look like they're violent, but they're not. Who's violent here? Who's using the guns? It's the government against the politically, ideologically disfavored group, pro-lifers. Yeah. Pro-life people are peaceful. We're the ones that believe that all people are made in the image of God and therefore equally valuable, deserving of protection without qualification. And that includes preborn boys and girls. That's what's happening right now. I'm hesitant to give too much credit to the FBI. I'm happy that arrests have been made. I'm really happy. It's bittersweet. Yeah. I mean, it's a win that indictments were made, but it's a loss that it took 8 months of us, you know, basically hammering on the FBI through the media and the launch of a House Judiciary Committee to investigate them. It just makes me wonder, you know, the FBI and the DOJ are taking responsibility for allegedly finding these perpetrators. But I wonder if the Miami police actually solved the case and the DOJ conveniently took credit. And the reason I say that is because the FBI is supposed to help local law enforcement. Local law enforcement is always supposed to take the lead on the investigation. That's what they told us in our investigation. That's what the local police told us in our investigation. And now they're making it look like they're taking the lead and taking responsibility for the indictments. So I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. At least it should be.
Yeah,
it should be.
I hope so. Yeah, you talk about concern. We should be outraged over this. These suspects allegedly had ties to Antifa, didn't they? Anything going to be followed up on that? And you know, what do we know about that Antifa connection?
You know, you mentioned the Thomas More Society on the lead up.
Yeah.
They're taking the lead on defending Mark Houck in Pennsylvania. And the leader of Thomas More Society, the president, Tom Brecka, his house was doxxed. And they had an Antifa-like James Revenge, essentially a protest at his house with graffiti, incendiary devices. The police sat there and watched it happen. I mean, when we saw these videos, we're like, these are Antifa people. They had the masks. They had the big black masks on their face. They had they're using the same tactics. They're using, they're using the graffiti signature scrawls. They were using this militant kind of Bolshevik revolutionary style, similar to James Revenge.
Yep.
And the fact that these James Revenge people that were indicted last week, it's not surprising that they have Antifa links. We had similar issues in Buffalo. And it was clear that these people had similar, you know, types of activity
Reverend, I think you said it bad. There is an ideological hatred for pro-lifers, which is just so bizarre, right? I mean, nonviolent, they care, they're compassionate, they're defenders of life. But this is not just with the DOJ or the FBI or Antifa or any other group you want to point to. What's your take on this? This is a little tangential to what we're talking about, but I was just shocked when the vice president, when Kamala Harris gave her speech the other day, and she omitted the right to life, the inalienable right to life, when she quoted the Declaration of Independence in a speech on abortion. I mean, she very conveniently forgot that, didn't she?
She did. There's no way you can forget that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are endowed by our Creator with the inalienable right to life, right? That is the foundational element. That's a presumed element to any government, is that you have human life to be governed. The fact that she would leave that out is telling in and of itself. It speaks volumes about the fact that they're looking to change the very fabric and foundation of our governmental structure. The reason why they're coming after pro-life people is not because they like abortion. It's because of what abortion gives them. Yeah. And pro-life people are able to articulate the opposite, which is the foundation of society. And that is that we're all made in the image of God and therefore equally valuable. That's the foundation of blind justice. That's the foundation of human dignity. It's not the government that gives us dignity. It's not the government that gives us rights and equality. Right. It's God.
That's so true. Final thing, because I got to leave it here. I'm really up against the clock. I saw one other story. New York City's now the first city to hand out free abortion pills. What's happening in your state there? You're in Buffalo, I know, but fill us in on what's going on and how rabid the state has become.
Oh, this New York State is rabid. We're actually serving patients all across New York State, including downstate into New York City. And the fact that New York is getting into the business of abortion is going to put New York State on the hook for a medical malpractice lawsuits. I mean, they're saddling the taxpayer with unlimited lawsuits and victims of sex trafficking and rape victims, yep. As well as the injury that comes from these very dangerous chemical coat hangers that are that they're basically giving away to, they say, girls, yeah. And then women. You know, this is a terrible, terrible travesty. This is serial malpractice, and the state, New York State, is getting involved. So, not just protecting it, but providing it.
I've never seen anything like it on so many different levels, from law enforcement to government handing out these death pills and so much more. There's of course, as you know, the ramifications that follow from this, the residual, the collateral damage for women and their husbands and boyfriends and everyone else continues to ripple out. Keep up the good work. We're praying for you, and you and I will talk again soon. Thanks for being here, okay? Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, this September, I'm heading the Relevant Radio's Eucharistic Revival Pilgrimage to Italy with Nativity Pilgrimage. This is available to you. Information available at relevantradio.com/Italy.
Thankfully, Miranda Devine at the New York Post may have brought us a little closer to the answer. So she analyzed the documents that we do have, the ones found on Hunter Biden's famous laptop. And on that laptop, she found a remarkable email, an email the Justice Department has never shown to the public, despite the fact its agents have had it for years. And the document that Miranda Devine found indicates that Hunter Biden had classified information in his possession. Almost certainly that came from his father, then the vice president. And that he used that information to make piles of money for the Biden family while working at a fake job in Ukraine.
You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Tucker Carlson talking about the connection Hunter Biden, his father Joe Biden, the president, information that is potentially on the laptop, and his connection to, I think it was Burisma is the company I think he was part of over in Ukraine. It's bizarre. And I was thinking, look, let's say there is classified documents, and I don't want to talk too much about this. I was just saying, if there was classified documents in that garage and you have a cell phone, you could easily take a picture of them, upload them to your computer, right? And then sell them, right? But who knows? Speculation. Speaking of Ukraine, though, you heard earlier Russian naval ships are somewhere now in the Western Atlantic Ocean carrying a load of hypersonic missiles, missiles that allegedly can go 9 times the sound of speed, or the speed of sound, I should say. Let me get that right. Their distance is 600-plus miles. So I was mentioning earlier how, I don't say they're totally indefensible, but they're really hard to counter. And this technology, I think, is threatening. So if something like that was unleashed, you'd have 5 minutes tops to get cover, right? It's not a whole lot of time, is it? Maggie, where would you go? 5 minutes ago, you're here at the Relevant Radio Network headquarters, right? In Studio One. It's like there's nowhere to go, right? The Russian Defense Ministry said the ship carried out, you know, simulations. There was actually no missiles fired, but I think they're sending America a message. We just agreed to send tanks. Britain and Germany are thinking about doing that to the Ukraine. And this comes right on the heels of that. We're going to supply Ukraine with main battle tanks. And it's something that's been debated for a few months now. And Russia's been warning against it. They've been saying, hey, hold on. That's a major escalation in what they believe really is a proxy. We're in a proxy war with Russia right now. And, you know, Russian officials have been speaking a lot more freely lately about saying, you know, we might use even more powerful weapons in our arsenal. Nuclear weapons, right? Will they use tactical nukes on Ukraine? You're going to send tanks over? We may use more powerful weapons. No doubt the ship that's sailing in the Atlantic is meant to be a threat. It's a warning to us. But right now, and I want to zoom out from militaries and from governments, and I want to zoom back in on really who is suffering. I saw a woman who was born and raised in an area of Ukraine. She hasn't had water since February 24th, 2022. She hasn't had electricity in that area. Her face was smudged with dirt. She had multiple coats on, but this was her home. She says, where am I to go? Where am I to go? It's the people of Ukraine who are paying the cost. They are suffering. And we go back to our homes. We turn up our heat because it's a little cold. We take our hot shower. We open our refrigerator. You know, you get your eggs or whatever else you have in there out, right? Millions of people have been displaced from their homes. And many have fled to other countries. It'll take a very long time before Ukraine ever gets back to what it was. Countless cities and towns are without power. It's all part of the strategy of Vladimir Putin to take out the water, the gas, the electricity, the power to these people in a critical time here. It is cold in Ukraine. Those who remain behind have become used as really the sounds of whistles followed by explosions. I mean, bombed out buildings are everywhere. The German newspaper has been reporting on a city in Bakhmut in the Donbass region where 70,000 people, 73,000 to be exact, where they used to live. You know how many people are there now? 8,000. That's all. You know, I think about what happens. The power goes out in our own town, right? I mean, how quickly will food run out if there was ever a tragedy in this town, right? In the town you live. Those grocery stores would be depleted in no time. How are these people getting food with only 8,000 people? How do you keep, you know, how do you keep your infrastructure running? Only 8,000 people who've managed with a running generator maybe once a day to power up phones or maybe a load of wash. They're relying on international charities to come and bring food and medicine and other supplies. And we haven't talked a whole lot about the suffering of these people. And I thought today we should do that. We'll pray the chaplet in about 20 minutes and we'll remember these people. And this is all because Vladimir Putin unjustly invaded that country. I'm joined now by John Berger. He's a longtime reporter and editor in the Catholic Press, and has recently come out with a book. It's a book-length interview with Archbishop Shevchuk, I believe is how you say his last name. He's a leader of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, and it's called At the Foot of the Cross. And if you want to really get a different perspective on what is now unfolding over there, you might want to read that. It's available at our Sunday Visitor Press. That's osv.com, osv.com, At the Foot of the Cross. Hey, John, thank you for joining me today. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, you know, not many people outside of Ukraine know about the bishop. And what is his name? Did I get that right?
That's right. His name is Sviatoslav Shevchuk. And he's often referred to as, officially Major Archbishop of Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. but informally, at least in the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, which he heads, he's often referred to as the Patriarch. The Vatican has not officially designated him Patriarch of the Church yet.
So, John, why did you choose to interview him for this piece?
I had met him in 2018 at the Supreme Convention of the Knights of Columbus in Baltimore, where he gave the keynote address. I interviewed him for Aletheia, the website for which I work. And in the wake of that, I was chatting with one of his assistant priests who floated the idea of writing a biography of him. He had been major archbishop, head of the church since 2011. And although he had done some and collaborated on some books in Italian and Polish, there was no English language biography of him at the time. Yeah. So he agreed to do it, but he agreed to do a book length interview rather than be the subject of a biography.
That's good. So share a little bit about what he's seeing. What's the greatest suffering that this shepherd is witnessing right now? How does he describe what's unfolding in Ukraine?
Well, from last February 24th, he really saw it firsthand because the Russians went straight for the jugular at first, trying to attack the capital of Kyiv, hoping to decapitate the government. They were at that point lobbing missiles and bombs at military targets, but nobody really knew what was going to happen. So people took shelter. His Beatitude, Vyacheslav, opened the cathedral of Kyiv to people in the area to serve as a bomb shelter in the basement. Since that time, and he himself was actually on a hit list that reportedly was put out by top Kremlin officials. So he had to sort of go to an undisclosed location for a time. But after the Russian forces were repelled from the Kyiv area, he was able to move around a bit more. He could see the destruction that was taking place, not only against military targets and civilian targets, but also some church facilities. He visited Bucha, where there had been some, mass graves discovered of local Ukrainians that were murdered by the invaders and this sort of thing. He's very close to Caritas Ukraine, and Caritas is responding directly to people's needs, especially, as you mentioned before, the attacks against the infrastructure, which are causing people basically to live in the cold and the dark at this time of year.
What are your thoughts? There are some people, when I was talking about Vladimir Putin invading, there are some people in the U.S. who are saying, and hold on, Russia was actually right to invade Ukraine because of how corrupt the government is there. They're concerned, of course, about NATO on its border. We do know for a fact that, there was some corruption there. We have also these links to potential stuff that was going on with the Bidens. How does the Archbishop see the invasion? How does he interpret what has unfolded?
Well, as he would say, Ukraine was not a threat to anyone, certainly not to Russia. Russia is so much more powerful than Ukraine, so much larger. It has 11 time zones, the territory. The Ukrainian military had become so small in recent years that it's almost laughable that anyone would think it was a threat. I mean, Putin supposedly felt that there were Nazis in Ukraine, and he wanted to denazify the country and demilitarize it. There wasn't much demilitarization to happen, really.
Yeah, I know you asked the bishop why Ukraine should matter to the rest of the world. I know there's talk here in the U.S. as to whether or not we should continue our support or not. It's a question a lot of people in the U.S. have right now. Should we be over there? What was his answer? How does he see it?
in response to the question, why should
why does Ukraine
matter?
Right.
It's long been a meeting point between East and West, and I think it can be a mediator between the two.
Hey, John.
I don't know really how much more I can say on that.
Hey, your book, if people want to get it, what's the best way to connect to it?
Well, the website, Our Sunday Visitor, osvcatholicbooks.com.
osv.com, and it's
coming
out
on February 13th.
So it's going to soon be released. That's good. All right, good. So that's coming up in a couple of weeks. You must be excited about that. At the Foot of the Cross, sure. Available at Our Sunday Visitor Press. The website is osv.org, and you can go ahead and check
com.
It out. .com, sorry, osv.com. Hey, John, thank you for your good work. Look forward to seeing that. When it comes out, we'll dive into it, okay?
Thank you so much, Drew. God bless.
God bless you. It's John Berger. Up against the clock, I need to take a very short pause. I will be back on the other side. A lot to get into. Packed show today. Stay with me. This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Pray, hope, and don't worry. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, coming up next.
Looking forward to praying with you. And, of course, I'll try to take as many calls as I can. If you have a special need or intention, it's relevantradio.com. And, we'll go to our Twitter page, at Drew Mariani Show. And Maggie will take them on Twitter. You can call me, 888-914-9149. And, of course, send me your answer prayers at the email, drew@relevantradio.com. No, that's right. Right, Maggie? I'm zoning out here. Yeah, that's the email for the show. I have so many emails. You know, I don't know, how many emails do you have? I must have about 10. I got one for junk. I've got one for financial stuff. I got one for the show. I got one for the network. I got so many different emails. I almost have a dozen of them. And I thought over the holidays, I was just going to, you know, get rid of them all and just keep like two, you know, just keep it really simple. Yeah, I do wish. Maggie's saying you wish. I do wish. I mean, email can be a time suck at it. I mean, it just disappears. With trying to get through all that stuff. So if you do write to me, though, into the show, if you send me an email, drew@relevantradio.com, I do see and I do read everything that comes in. I do my best to pray for everything that comes in and, of course, bring it to air if we can. But if you really want to get your intention on the air, it's at Drew Mariani Show. That's where Maggie will put it up. You can follow me on social media, too, at Drew Mariani. In fact, Maggie, I put up a graphic that the network gave me yesterday. It's of the pilgrimage that we're going to be going on in September. If you can find it, maybe you can share it and everybody can have access to it. I've been talking a lot. I haven't really talked a lot about this pilgrimage coming up, and I thought maybe I could just get you up to speed on it. This is a special time here in this country where the bishops are really calling for a revitalization, you know, an awakening of what we have, this great treasure in the Eucharist. And I think part of the problem we have with our kids leaving the church, you know, this exodus out of the church, it's because people don't recognize what we have in the church, right? That we have Jesus truly present, body, blood, soul, and divinity. Jesus, he once lamented to St. Faustina. He says, people don't seem to understand, you know, the sacrament of Holy Communion, his real presence. He said this to her. He says, when I come to a human heart, my hands are full of all kinds of graces that I want to give to that soul. But souls, they don't pay attention to me. They leave me to myself. They busy themselves with other things. They treat me as though I was a dead object. It's such a tragic, tragic reality, right? And those are the words of the Lord. Those are the words of the Lord. The Lord has, time and time again, tried to take the blinders off of us, the human race, right? He gives us this great gift, right? And across the centuries, there have been Eucharistic miracles that have taken place. I mean, one of the most famous is that Eucharistic miracle in Lanciano, Italy. It's a small little coastal town on the Adriatic. Absolutely beautiful. You will love Lanciano if you ever get a chance to go there. And the word Lanciano means the lance. And the tradition behind Lanciano is that St. Longinus, he was the soldier who was at the foot of the cross and to make sure Christ was dead. He's the one who thrust his sword into the side of the Lord, right? Apparently he had vision problems. And they claim that the blood and water that flowed from the side of our Lord, you see that image depicted in Divine Mercy, it hit his eyes. And his eyes were cured. He was cured. Even Christ hanging on a cross with his dead body, his blood and water, which gushed forth from his sacred side, brought about not just the removal of whatever problem Lanciano had with his vision. Legend has it that he converted after the events of the crucifixion. Don't forget, he was there when Christ died and the rock split and the earth trembled and the veil of the temple split in two. They say the dead left their graves, right? There's a description in the scriptures how they walked the street. Imagine being around that day. Lanciano was there. He was eventually martyred for the faith. So in Lanciano, right? At the time of this Eucharistic miracle, there was a tremendous heresy spreading in the church about the true presence of our Lord in the Eucharist. And there was a monk there that was having doubts, and his doubts were growing stronger. And one morning at Mass during the consecration, he began to shake. He began to tremble. And his face, you know, he turned to the people to show them what happened. He turned around. The host, in this moment of doubt that he had, had turned to human flesh. And the wine in the chalice, it actually turned into human blood. This was 1,300 years ago. The miracle didn't end, right? This priest had a radical conversion as a result of this, right? In 1970, scientists thought, what is this, right? How can human flesh, how can this stuff survive the march of time? You know, it would imagine a piece of flesh. What happens to it? It dries up, it shrivels up, it turns to dust, right? Open any grave for someone who's been dead for a while. So in 1970, they take this miracle of Lanciano, this flesh, they examine it, and they discover a couple things that are absolutely amazing. And I'll talk more about it maybe in the future. They found that it wasn't just any flesh. It was human heart tissue. And the blood was human blood. The blood type, everybody says, what was the blood type? What was the blood type? Blood type was AB, right? The blood had the characteristics, the scientists said, they couldn't explain this, of living blood. There were no preservatives in this. Again, 1,300 years, over a millennia, almost a millennia and a half. They found this slice of heart tissue in a way that science could not explain. We did not have the technology or the precision in those days to be able to do that. The flesh was real flesh. The blood was real blood. The flesh and blood belonged to human species. And it's a piece of heart tissue, piece of myocardium, an endocardium. In the flesh, they also found some of the vagus nerve, also the left ventricle of the heart. It was unbelievable. The flesh is a heart. That's what's in Lanciano, Italy. That host is a heart. It's a piece of heart tissue. The flesh and blood have the same blood type, AB. Blood type identical to what is on the Shroud of Turin. I know you're thinking about that. Is that the same blood type on the Shroud of Turin? Yes. There's a lot more to it. I don't have time to go into all the science, but I will share more of that with you. But it's one of the great miracles that we have where Christ says, I'm truly present. I've got grace to give to you. I want to give you my heart, literally. And so next time you receive the Eucharist, think about that. You know, spend some time before the Lord truly present in the Eucharist. I also want to invite you to do something else. I was just thinking about this. You know, I heard my promo run at the top of the hour. I'm extremely privileged that Relevant Radio has come to me. And they said, Drew, would you like to take the pilgrimage for Relevant Radio? We're going to do a Eucharistic revival tour. And of course, we're not going to say no. Of course, I've been to Italy many times. It's an enchanted place. I mean, it's beautiful. The food is spectacular. People are great. But there's a grace in this place. There are Eucharistic miracles up and down Italy. And we're going to go see some of them. One of the places we will go is to Lanciano, Italy. We're going to pray there. We're going to have Mass there. You're going to be able to see this heart tissue. You're going to be able to see this miracle that took place 1,300 years ago. You know, I really encourage you to come. We're going to visit the home of St. Rita, where her incorrupt body lies, and the relic of her on that day, the same day we go to Lanciano. You know, there's so much we're going to do. It's just a fraction of it. Let me give you a website to check out, because the trip is already filling up. I know it's going to be closed off in just a matter of a couple of weeks. So really pray about it, think about it, and decide if you want to come. Just go to relevantradio.com. And /Italy, relevantradio.com/Italy. You'll see a phone number for Nativity Pilgrimage. They're the one running the trip, putting it together. You can call them and get all the details about where we're going, what the itinerary is. You can download a brochure. But it's relevantradio.com/Italy. You'll find the telephone number there. Call, at least reserve your spot, because once it fills up, there's only a waiting list. And a lot of people couldn't make it to Israel, but I hope you can come with me. It'll be extraordinary.